So Mike, the turn is to you, and we can start. Everyone should have the slide deck that we sent to you a few days ago. And again, feel free to send me some information if you have questions on the presentation afterwards.
So good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be with you on this beautiful spring day in Vermont. So it's wonderful to be here. So I'd like to start, as Debbie said, with the investment results, and then we'll talk about the philosophy, and we'll talk about how the portfolio is positioned and what we're thinking about in terms of the fantastically interesting world we live in today, of course. So to go right to slide two. So I want to start with a philosophical point, which is that long-term investment excellence, unfortunately, is not something that can be delivered with consistency over the short term. So as you can see, you're probably going to get a sense of what I'm talking about right here on slide two. So when you look at something that we don't see that often here, so when you look at this chart, we have the three main pools in the foundation pools that are offered. The long-term pool, the socially responsive pool, which is also a long-term pool, but uses a values framework to form its investments, and the midterm pool, which is a more conservatively managed pool. And I'll show you the aspects a little later, but the midterm pool is a lower return pool over time because it's more conservatively managed. It has more fixed income, essentially. So the point I was starting with my philosophical note earlier is you can see the long-term pool actually underperforming its benchmark for the 12-month period that just ended. So on a negative note, we would have earned 2.6%, not 1.6% if we had just used index funds. So we paid a tax for actually being more diversified using active management and a variety of other things. If we just actually owned, you can see it would be that 70% global stocks, 30% bonds, we would have earned even more. CPI+5 isn't something we can actually invest in, but it's there because that is our long-term asset goal for preserving purchasing power of these assets. Now, the 1.6, while not a happy number, is actually not as bad a number as I would have guessed if you think about what happened at the end of last year with a fairly significant sell-off in the market. So we had a very big rebound in the beginning of this year, and so it's all buried inside of that latest year number. I can tell you that the portfolio actually just had an absolutely fantastic April, and basically made that all this relative ground you see here in the 1 month. And the good news is that the year-to-date figure, so here I'm showing year-to-date, the pool through April is up about 10% or so. You're at 10.2%, excuse me. 10.5%, pardon me. Taking off the percentage point, 10.5% year-to-date, which is outperforming the benchmark. And so we're kind of returning back to our historic pattern, which now if you take a look at the more important data, which is longer-term, you'll see for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, and 15 years, considerable premiums to the benchmark. And we'll talk a little later about how we got to those numbers. The socially responsive pool has been a very strong pool really the last 7 years, and it's now just slightly behind its benchmark over 10 years. But one of the things that we're very pleased about, if you think about it, is 10 years ago was March of 2009. And that was a very ugly time in the world and in the market from an economic perspective and otherwise. And this is where investing gets very interesting, which is it's when everybody is terrified that you really actually don't want to be terrified in terms of your investment strategy, at least. And so, frankly, if you think about 10.3% per year over the last decade, that's a lot of return. And it's the last thing people would have expected. Now, we'll get to the tenets of the strategy a little later, but they were extremely important in how we got this 10.3% return, so I will come back to that. So let me just show you one more slide, and then I'll pause if you have questions about performance, which is slide three. So we look at performance here compared to a universe of endowments and foundations, which is the investor, of course, universe. So in the green bar, you can see the same performance numbers I showed you before, but we have a different benchmark, quote unquote, which is the median of this database, which is about 800 endowments and foundations throughout the country. The median, of course, but you don't think about statistics all day, is the middle of the distribution, so half did better, half did worse than the median number. So you'll see the one-year number was a disappointing number. In fact, 1.6% was below the median, and if you look at the beige bar at the top, it was in the bottom quartile. The good news for us is if you look at every other time period, with the exception of 7 years, where we just, unfortunately, dropped into the second quartile, just ever so barely, top quartile, which is top 25% of endowments and foundations, and for 15 years, top 10% of endowments. I believe you're actually top 7% in the technical place that you are in that distribution. So, again, extremely strong long-term performance. But again, I will go back to the earlier comment. I wish there was a way to be top quartile and do it all the time consistently, but I don't think that's possible. The reason it's not possible is markets can be very unusual beasts at points in time. What markets are favoring or not favoring has a lot of impact on our performance, and we're not particularly concerned with doing the things that are popular. We're trying to do the things that are, we hope, right and smart. And so that sometimes will create shortfalls. And the key, we'll talk about a little later, is whether or not you did a good job making decisions and then whether you have the confidence and conviction to stick with your decisions, even when they don't look as smart as you wish they did. So let me just pause for a moment there and see if there are any questions on that performance.
So if you want to ask a question, just press your star 6.
Hi, it's Tom Smith there. I don't ever remember the VCF portfolio being in the fourth quartile. Do you have a recollection of that?
I do. I think it was fourth. I'm going to say the time I think it was in the fourth quartile. I'll have to go back and verify this, Tom. But I have certainly vivid nightmares about it because it was just an ugly time for our strategy. June of 2016. And that happened, Tom, because back then, that's when interest rates around the world started becoming negative for the first time in a very meaningful way. And there was a gigantic rush in the markets to anything that had yield, no matter how dumb the investment was or foolish it was, I should say. And we're just not going to do that. We're not going to overpay for things just so we can get some income from them. And interest rates were so low. So it created this massive distortion in the markets, which I vividly remember because I remember thinking, oh my God, this is really ugly. How long is it going to last? And you know it's dumb, but you don't know how it can last for years, who's to say. And I will say I was fortunate because a year later, the whole thing reversed. Interest rates stayed negative, but the markets readjusted to the fact that investments actually do have a fundamental value and momentum eventually peters out. So we had a huge year after that, and that's why you don't remember it. But I'm hoping the same thing will happen now. I will add this one distorting factor that fourth quartile number for this year. So we don't do excuses, just, you know, we're the fourth quartile because we have stuff that, frankly, the market doesn't like, and we always make some mistakes in our portfolios, too. But the other factor that's really driving the fourth quartile outcome is the fact that we do not, you'll see in a minute, we do not have a ton of private assets. So when you look at calendar 2018, where the markets were down, depends on which market you look at, S&P was down 4.5, global market was down 10 or so, private asset portfolios never really took their medicine last year, and so the typical portfolio, I mean, here, the numbers we see are up 12, 15, 18% since 18. So that disparity between private asset returns against double-digit profits and borderline double-digit losses in public equity markets for the year 2018 is important in the universe comparison because the average endowment manager in that universe has 15, 20% or more in private assets. We have 5 to 8% in private assets. And so we had a big tax on our kind of our ability to compete. Short-term doesn't mean a darn thing, frankly, but it is a factor that affects us. So this one doesn't feel as bad as me in 16, because in 16 it was just a carnage, essentially. That was the last time I remember.
I have a follow-up question for you, Mike. On your previous slide, I noticed that the socially responsive pool was almost 200 basis points ahead of the long-term pool. Does that have anything to do with hedge funds?
I don't think it does, Tom. I'll have to take a look at the exact detail. I can tell you one thing I know it has a lot to do with. The socially responsible pool has a big position in a manager named Generation Investment Management, a great, great firm. The long-term pool has a position too, it's not as large. Generation has had an absolutely stunningly good year. In fact, I sometimes say that there are managers out there who we think the world of, and Generation is one of them. And yet their performance is so good that even we were like, well, they're not really that good. So they just have an incredible run. And in part, it's because of stock selection. And then the related point, they've been very heavily overweight in the U.S. in a global strategy. U.S. markets, you know, frankly, is defying gravity again. You know, they're just way too expensive compared to markets outside the U.S. is the generic point. But so the social responsible pool, I believe the vast majority of that spread you see there comes from, yes, having a little more equities, and then you could say the hedge funds are the issue. But it's Generation specifically being a very chunky position, and Generation very wisely having a lot in the U.S. at the time we wanted to. So those are the major factors.
Any other questions? Okay. We'll keep on going. And again, press your star 6, and then we'll pause again for questions. Thank you.
Okay. So let's talk about, as you might guess, Colonial and any investment advisor like us gets a lot of inbound inquiries from managers who tell us, the people who tell us they're great investors and they have great track records. And so I just showed you a very impressive track record. And the problem with anybody with a great track record is you have to ask the question, well, exactly how do you do that? And if the answer is, well, I thought of things, or we thought of things in the Vermont Community Foundation that no one has ever considered or thought about, and we have incredibly unique insights into the future and the world, if I were you, I'd run as far and fast away from that as I could, because that's just not repeatable. So the critical thing that is important to understand here is we're not doing complicated things. We're not doing difficult things. We're just utilizing some natural advantages we have and then keeping a cool head. It's really not that much more complicated. So if you look on slide 4, first point, a strict adherence to a strategy that relies on decisions with a high probability of success. What does that mean? What it basically means is we're not trying to figure out how trade negotiations are going to end up. We're not trying to figure out what the economy is going to do this year. And a lot of the things that, unfortunately, people spend a lot of time thinking about, we don't think about at all. And the reason we don't is because we have no unique insights into those things, number one. Two, because we're not fortune tellers. Two, we don't believe that the information we have possibly be right and unique enough for it to matter in the market, because if you know something about the economy, probably everybody else does too, and market prices already reflect that. So we avoid things that people unfortunately spend a lot of time on because they're just not very productive things to do. So instead, what we focus on, which is a lot, in much ways easier but also harder, we focus on simple things like, what are assets priced at, say? Are they priced optimistically or pessimistically? And we're attracted to things that are priced pessimistically. This is not hard to do. The problem with it, though, why it gets hard, where it gets hard, is that it doesn't necessarily give you any short-term gratification whatsoever. You can buy, for example, a 50-cent dollar, and it can turn into a 40-cent dollar, which means you've lost money, or a 30-cent dollar. And what you really should be doing up there is just having more of that dollar in your portfolio. But again, it's unfortunate because people, all of them, us included, have to answer as you should for short-term outcomes, as well as long-term outcomes. And we're kind of very agnostic to the short-term, because we're much more concerned getting the right long-term outcomes. So, but there's a high rate. Your success in a diversified pool of 50 cent dollars is very high, and that's why the reference is good. Second point, collaboration. There are no stores of knowledge in the universe. Colonial Consulting is not a store of knowledge. The Investment Committee is not a store of knowledge. Foundation Management is not a sole store of knowledge. But you bring three like-minded groups of people together with very similar objectives and perspectives that are different, and you get a much better outcome. It's what collaboration is all about, and that's been a very big part of the equation here. The community, the investment committee meets about another hour, and I can assure you it's not Colonial saying, let's do these three things, and everyone just passively nodding and say, sure, whatever you say. This is going to be robust debate and discussion, and that's what should happen. That's how it works. And last but not least, this is something that is wonderful. We have a $200 million pool, the long-term pool. There's a lot of things that can be done. Small allocations to new managers, for example. Small allocations to very concentrated managers. A bunch of things that can be done that add a lot of value over time. But you have to have a big pool of capital to execute those things. So the minimums are way too high on the money. So those three things, are really significant. Go to the next slide, you'll see the other principles we operate under are very simple as well. We basically have a mix of stocks, bonds, and some alternatives. Tom asked the hedge funds before, we'll come back to hedge funds a little later, but they are part of the mix here too. The second point, which may sound odd to say after you talk about hedge funds, is are you deploying fee dollars efficiently? So what does that mean? It doesn't mean fee minimization, because fee minimization, you would never own hedge funds. You would never own a lot of things we own, actually, because the fees are higher. But we're not focused necessarily on, we're not focused on minimizing fees, but we're focused on fees. So the way you think about that is, if we're going to pay a higher fee, we expect something for it. And if we don't get it, we will not stick to that strategy. We're not interested in enriching investment managers, that's for sure. But capital efficiency means that we're willing to pay a fee, but we have a lot of skepticism about whether we should or we shouldn't, and then we need to get something tangible as a result in exchange for that fee. And last but not least, we're very focused on controlling risk. This is not, despite the big 10.35% returns for the last decade per year, this is not an overly aggressive portfolio. I think that's a really important point to admit it. And you can see on slide 6. So, as you may have seen earlier, we had a 70-30 mix that we compared the long-term pool to, and we're suffering relative to that pool, that mix. And if you look at slide 6, here you can see the long-term pool, the SR pool, the mid-term pool, asset mix strategy. So the long-term pool is only 52.5% in growth in stocks, not 70. We're 21% plus in fixed income of various shapes and sizes. We do have the hedge fund at 13, and we have private assets at 8%. We also have the Vermont investments at 5%, of course. So this pool is very diversified. For those who don't know, we've haven't come across the term special opportunities before. That's where we put our highest octane investments, so things that are very focused, that can be volatile, they can be very concentrated. And we put them there because we like to cordon them off and make sure we're looking at them as a separate group because they can be very volatile. They tend to be incredibly big return drivers for us, and they're important, and they're the best place where you see scale being used to the advantage of everyone in the pool. So that's the basis of special options are equity strategies, so it's very clear what we're doing with that. The SR pool has a little bit more in equities, which also, to Tom's question a minute ago, is one of the reasons that the pool has actually done better in the last year because it has more equities and has more U.S., as I mentioned before. It doesn't have alternatives other than a 5% private asset exposure that we're looking to fill with high-impact investments. And then we have the midterm pool, which is basically 50-50 X the Vermont investments. That's the most conservative on this three. Let me pause again and see if you have questions about the mix before we switch gears to the investment firms you're using.
If you want to ask a question, you can press star 6, that will take you off mute.
Tom, tell us over the Merck. Can you give me an example of what positions in private assets are invested in?
Oh, sure. So private assets are invested in a lot of different things. It's a range from buyouts to venture capital to growth equity to real estate to a variety of different things. Let me give you a good example. I'll give you my favorite, so mine, if you want me to do another one, I will too. So we committed, the foundation committed about $1 million, about $1 million to a fund called Confidence. So this is not a fund of funds. We do use some fund of funds from time to time, but Confidence is a manager based in New York that invests in the healthcare space. This was actually their first fund. They raised it in 2014. So the foundation is willing to give experienced, talented people who are just starting their own businesses capital because we think there's a real edge to being early with people. And so Confidence, I'm using them as an example for a reason. We should have put $10 million with them. We paid them $1 million. They have essentially, it's basically small healthcare, small to big cap healthcare companies that Confidence believes can be improved essentially and sold eventually. And I bring up Confidence because we put $1 million in and it's got 5 years later a 73% IRR and generated four times our money. And this is all, although this is not priced rounds, this is actually cash back in the foundation's pocket, but a huge driver. I'll give you one more example because it's not fair, just to give you the one that's worked out the best. We also recently made commitment to something called Lakestar. Lakestar is also a manager that operates, they operate in Europe in the venture capital growth equity space area. And you might say Europe and venture capital sounds like a weird set of words put to a single sentence. But actually there's some very interesting venture capital companies, venture-backed companies in Europe, Spotify for example. And Lakestar is a really, really wired in, fantastically capable manager. That's a brand new commitment. They haven't even drawn the capital yet, so that is a place where we expect to have a lot of return, but right now we don't, of course. Does that help a little?
Yeah, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Any other questions? Okay,
that's right. So slide 7. So we went back to the beginning of this presentation. Despite the last 12 months where I had to spend 3 minutes of your valuable time explaining why we underperformed, as opposed to banks, I don't have to do that very often, we tend to outperform benchmarks. The custom benchmarks that we use mimic our asset allocation strategy index funds. So if you're outperforming those by 1% plus a year, obviously we're doing something right with the choices of active management. And that usually is, a lot of raised eyebrows around that, mainly because, for good reason, the active management community is, generally speaking, a failure. Mediocrity rules the day. Mediocrity less fees and other costs is essentially a subpar outcome for those who are the investors. So the first point is we absolutely agree with those who say index funds are better as a generic statement. And we do use some index funds in the portfolio, to be clear. However, at the same time, to make a blanket statement that all active management is a failure is not true. There are I got there must be tens of thousands of active metric choices out there. You look at every possible market in the world, and there are, I've got hundreds, actually, that are actually quite useful and interesting, maybe hundreds. So our goal is to find those.
Just so people know, can you press star 6 if you haven't? We're hearing some feedback from some of the lines. Thank you.
So we have to go out and find these sponsors. So how do we do that? So Colonial has a team of about 23 people right now whose job it is to go out and find people wherever they are in the world and try to, one, figure out who's good, and two, for the really best firms, sometimes we have to wait until they're willing to accept capital. A lot of the very best managers are not just open anytime you want. They don't have marketing teams. They do not call you. You have to sometimes beg and plead. Believe it or not. And so we spent a lot of time on that, and this is where the foundation's been incredibly good about, you know, when opportunities arise, the committee is very willing to access to think about them and talk about them anytime we need them to. The committee is very willing to go in early on managers that, frankly, aren't as proven in their current situations as we might like, because if you wait until someone's proven, you don't have the chance to invest anymore. And so there's a lot of different things that are done. This is where, again, we use the pool and we use the talent of the committee to really generate a lot of excellence. So the four basic rules here on slide 7, if you were working at our firm, the first thing you'd be taught is returns are always accompanied by risk. So these firms that have done really, really well for us, there were risks. Sometimes the risks were just the way they invest. They're very concentrated. They make mistakes. It can be very painful. Sometimes the risks is they're brand new, and the people running it haven't run firms before, and there's all kinds of risks. They'll mess it up, or they'll get distracted, or they just aren't as good as we think they are. So there's always risk. And our goal, of course, is to make sure we get paid for that risk. And then, two, very important for you to diversify that risk. So even if one of these, we haven't actually had one really go badly, which is unfortunate because we will eventually. But the reality is that when they do go badly, you wouldn't even notice on the top line if we don't put 10% of our portfolio with somebody who's brand new. They get 1.5%, and if they have a hard time, it is a very small impact. Second point, we don't pick people. So if you're going to invest in people, for example, with very short or no track records, obviously we're not spending a lot of time thinking about their track records. There's two reasons for that. One is track records tell you a wonderful story of the past, and all we get is the future of the investment. So we need to be very clear about what we think will happen. And not predicting markets, not predicting economies, but predicting what human beings will behave as is not as hard as you might think in this business. So what we need to do is we need to understand the strategy, we need to know the key personnel, we need to avoid needless complexity. So when people create business models that are complicated, when they have strategies that are very hard to understand, we're not interested. Main reason being, the more complicated you make the machine, the easier it is for it to break. But the key point of this thing is no key personnel. We had an internship program at Colonial last summer, and the interns involved, they're all college kids. And they all spent 8 weeks with us, and they had the chance to participate in our research process and learn about how we do it. At the end of the summer, I don't know if they all got coached to ask the question that they did, but they all answered my questions at the end of the summer, which is, what did you learn about researching managers this summer that was a surprise to you? And they all said, and I was wrong on that, they all said, it's not quantitative. It's all about learning what makes people tick and get kind of peering into their soul. And I said, that's exactly right. So you know, they learned it well. And so that whole point about knowing people is a really big, big, big lesson. I want to say the last third point, we do not take risk on operations. Operational risk is a complete no-no. In fact, the foundation is backing a relatively new manager as we speak. And that manager has a chief operating officer who's got 19 years of experience and has built a rock-solid operating platform. So there's always an independent custodian or prime brokers, credible auditors, outside administrators, so there's no Bernie Madoff problem potentially lurking in this portfolio. We're extremely careful about that because there's no, like I said, there's no payoff in taking on that risk, and there's actually a huge downside, obviously. And last but least, it's an ongoing overlooking process. So I will skip past slide 8. And slide 9, except for the very bottom point, which I do want to emphasize on slide 9, which is that diversification is something that actually everybody talks about, but it's incredible to us how little is actually practiced in the real world. So yes, people own stocks and bonds, and they own sometimes hedge funds and other things, but they don't think about all the other ways you can diversify your asset base. So the foundation success, something I didn't point out I want to get to, and I should bring it up now. I'll get to this a little later, which is how hard it's been to be a value or price-sensitive investor as we are. But the way we've overcome that is with this last bullet point. We have diversification by strategy, which is everybody does. But we also diversify by location. So we have managers in Asia, Europe, the United States, everywhere you can imagine in this world. We actually have one in Africa, forgive me. We may have more soon. And so we'd like to diversify by location. And we do that because when you sit in different parts of the world, you see the world differently. One, you're a specialist in your area, and two, you see other things different than other people do too. You just live a different life. And on that point, younger people, more mid-career people, more mature people, they each have their positives and negatives. And our view is, like, if everything, if you have three things, you know, young, middle career, later in career, that all have positives and negatives, then there's a wonderful benefit to blending those things together. With an emphasis towards, by the way, just to be clear, mid to later career, and we love the mid, frankly. Mid's our favorite part of this spectrum, but we don't focus on just people in the middle of their career. And last but not least, gender and race. The fact is that people are different. And if, you know, depending on the color of your skin and your gender, you definitely have different life experiences. And again, doesn't mean that people are different makes them better. It doesn't mean that different makes them good contributors to the portfolio. But if we can find equally talented people who are very different from each other, we get a better portfolio, and that's ultimately what we're trying to do. So let me stop one more time and see, before we switch to the hedge funds, if there are questions on manager selection. And one thing I did leave out, which I do want to exercise to give you before I open for questions. The other component of our strategy is patience. We very strongly believe that this is not a rapid fire. Let's find the latest, greatest, shiny coin, and let's put it in and throw out something that we think maybe not as good anymore. We err on the side of sticking with people for very long periods of time. So the turnover of managers in this portfolio is actually quite low, and that's very purposeful. We believe that our research is good. The committee believes that the research is good. And if you think somebody is good and you peer into their soul, as I said earlier, unless you just get that wrong, which hopefully we won't do very often, you should be patient, and the performance will be what it will be. Sometimes it's weak, sometimes it's strong, and you put it all together, it needs to be strong, obviously. But patience is the thing that most investors lack. Has been another big part of the edge here over time.
So any questions from Mike at this point?
So we'll jump to slide 11. So Tom asked the quintessential question before, which is, you know, have the hedge funds hurt your returns? And this doesn't actually answer the question he has specifically to do that about a year. But this answers the question which most people probably have and should have, which is, why do you own these things exactly? Because hedge funds are a terrible investment plan. And I will return you to my earlier comments about active management being terrible. Yes, it's terrible, but it's not universally terrible. And hedge funds are definitely active management times 10 when it comes to the absurdity of a lot of hedge fund investing is much worse than most typical active management. However, there are probably 9,000 hedge funds out there, and again, we need to find 6. Or 5 or something in that neighborhood for this portfolio. And so to 5 or 6 great hedge fund leaders out there, I think it's fair to say nobody would argue that's not true. They do. So let's look at the record. It's the best way to show the hedge funds to talk about whether you've earned a return or not, not what we think we've been. So slide 11 is what we call volatility versus return diagram. Returns, of course, are the vertical scale, higher being better. Volatility or standard deviation is the scale on the bottom, so you go to the right. Think of that as being a much more uncomfortable existence, essentially. So first point, the period of time we used, February 1st, 2003, that's a weird date to start with. This is from March of this year, of course. And we picked that unusual date because that's when the foundation actually made its first hedge fund investment. So we've been investing in hedge funds now for more than 16 years. And so, again, I can assure you that the investment committee here, we've got people who are definitely hostile to the idea of hedge funds. We had some that are neutral. I don't think we have any fans, just to be clear. We've got some that are hostile and neutral. So here they still are in the portfolio. As I said earlier, this investment committee doesn't just sit around and just whatever pipe door says it's all good. So we still own these things. So why? And here's the why. So this diagram shows you the track record of the portfolio. Let me just describe the different points on it. The diamond on the far right-hand side of the page, that's that 70% global stocks, 30% bond mix that we talked about earlier as one of our benchmarks. The blue circle is the ETF long-term pull-out returns over this period of time. Again, these are all net of investment management. Everything on this page is net of fees, by the way. That blue circle has this wonderful quality, which we think is very important, obviously, which is it outperformed, of course, good news there, but it's also less volatility. I don't have the slides this time, but in the past, we looked at how this intersection between volatility and returns is really, really important when it comes to generating stronger charitable and philanthropic output, output defined as dollars spent and dollars still left in a fund over time. So, you know, volatility isn't something that should be allowed to drive the equation. But lowering it without lowering the returns is extremely powerful and creates more, you know, pure firepower when it comes to charitable and dropping impact of dollars. The yellow circle to the left and near the bottom, that's the bond market. We'll come back to that in a minute, but very important. Take a look at that. Is it a 3.5% return per year? With treasuries at 2.5% today, and they've been down here for a while, as we all know, and lower, it's very hard to envision a future where 10 years from now we're looking at even a 3.5% return on government bonds, at least, and you can also higher risk bonds, and maybe can make that higher, of course, but the reality is that this is probably not even repeatable, as unimpressive as it is. Now, move a little bit to the right, there's an orange circle, I think it's orange, to the right, a little bit below the yellow circle, that's the HFRI fund-to-fund index. So that's the reason people hate hedge funds, and they're, like I said earlier, they're right. So hedge funds have returned less than bonds over this period of time. They've had more volatility than bonds, and if you look at this other line, which is there's a line that runs from the hollow diamond at the bottom to the filled diamond at the upper right, that's what we call the capital market line. That's an infinite combination of global stocks and cash. And so if you're below that line, that means that you essentially, for the volatility you had, you could have basically been invested in some combination of stocks, cash, that's probably 40% stock, 60% cash, is probably what that point is on the line, and precisely what it did, and paid almost nothing and had a better return. As opposed to the hedge funds, which by the way, what I left out is that 3% return came at probably a 3% fee. So you gave half the money to the hedge fund community, and you got to keep half, and you got a lot less than bonds and some, you know, infinite combination of stocks and cash. So, again, we're still back to the same question, well, why the heck are some hedge funds in your portfolio? And I can assure you two things are different. The Democracy Foundation owns this track record, this orange circle. The two things that are different is, one, we wouldn't own hedge funds, and two, I don't think I'd be on this call with you right now. We've got to find you someplace else. They would have fired us long ago. The red circle is the one I want you to focus on, which is just above and a little bit to the right, well above and a little bit to the right of the orange circle. That's the Vermont Community Foundation hedge fund record. Now, let me be very clear, that's not what we call pro forma, which is when you take all the stuff you have today and just assume you had it 10 years ago, how you would have done. I won't use the New York term for that, but that's dishonest. This is instead the actual record. So every good decision, every bad decision, everything's in those numbers, and that's the return, again, net of investment management fees. So this is an interesting outcome. So I will tell you, I start my world thinking, if I think you need to earn 7% on a hedge fund to truly declare victory, and you'll see we're not there. We're just north of 6.25% right now over the last 16 years plus. So again, we're not satisfied, just to be clear. However, that 6.25% return with volatility of about 6% played a very useful role in this portfolio, which is one, it's an alternative to some of the bond exposure we otherwise would have had, because bonds are a wonderful way to diversify portfolios. Hedge funds are not as good a way to diversify portfolios, but they do diversify them. So we get paid 6.5% or in my world 7% plus to own a diversifier, that's a really good outcome for us. So when you look at the blue circle at the top of the page, you see the way that's been drawn to the left. That's largely because of the hedge fund. They made a very big contribution to moderating the volatility of the pool, and they haven't cost us very much return. And I will add one more thing. So just to put this in perspective, the 6% plus return from hedge funds is 6% volatility. You can see here, look at the far right, the 70-30 blend of stocks and bonds has had about 11% volatility, 10.5% volatility. If you had just stocks, you might say, well, why do you own the hedge funds? Just own more stocks. Well, stocks have had clearly a higher return, but they've had 15% volatility, which is basically hedge funds have been 60 to 70% less volatile than stocks. So this trade-off of getting a fairly good return, it should be better, and a lot less volatility, which we're very satisfied with, is really important to the portfolio. So I'll stop the long speech on hedge funds. Are there questions about that? Okay, so two more things. So finally, let's talk about the world we live in right now. So I remind you that ours is one, our strategy is one that's built on long-term thinking. And there's nothing that makes long-term thinkers happier than a predominance of short-term thinkers. And the reason we like that is because short-term thinkers tend to overreact to things. They tend to be an emotional crowd, yes, and they tend to misprice securities to a very significant extent. So skip ahead to slide 13 for a second, which is just one small but powerful graphic that shows you kind of what kind of world we've been living in since the global financial crisis. So this is something. This is this is something called the Fama-French value factor. So the Fama-French value factor, basically, Gene Fama and Ken French were two University of Chicago professors who started a firm amongst the starters of a firm named DFA, Dimensional Fund Advisors, which many of you may have heard of. Great, great passive investing firm. And Gene and Ken came up with these, a variety of ways to measure whether or not stocks were expensive or cheap. And so the value factor combines book value to price, it combines operating performance of businesses and the investment reinvestment business to come up with what are expensive versus cheap stocks. So the Abbott data series goes all the way back to 1926, and they had a value index they created out of their cheap stocks, and a growth index they created out of the expensive stocks. So that's the bar they created. So this chart looks at, on a rolling 10-year basis, how the value portfolio is done compared to the growth portfolio. And it's quite remarkable, which is that the value portfolio, up until we get to the right in a second, has dropped. Whenever the lines are blue, or the shaded area is blue, value is outperforming growth. And you can see, this is why academics love value, because it's almost too good to be true. Maybe it is, but we'll talk about that in a minute. And the performance is just stunning. Then you get to the far right, and whatever turns red, that means more expensive stocks are outperforming less expensive stocks. And the red, you'll see there's a little spike kind of almost to the far right, but not all the way, of course. That's the TMT bubble in 1999 kicking in. Then you'll see another little piece over in 12 or 13, and then you see that big red shaded area to the right, which is what we've been living in here now. Actually, think about it, for 15 years, essentially. It's not really, because the impact of this is all post the global financial crisis, but it's so powerful, the outperformance of high-priced stocks versus low-priced stocks, that you've dragged all these numbers in. So again, I want to remind you, this doesn't mean consistently over the 10 years that high-priced stocks from low-priced, but cumulatively it has, and that's what these numbers reflect. So this point to the far right, this reflects a market today that is dressing, has been and continues to address a lot of big macro issues. Everything from, you know, very heavy-headed central banks, everything to very low interest rates. And then last but not least, I don't think it's insignificant, that markets have changed in the sense of a lot more passive investing, a lot more ETFs, trading going on, and a lot of what we call algorithmic trading going on. Your computers essentially making the best decisions. And it creates a lot of momentum in the market. So it's just a fascinating time. And we bring it up to say that this is the world we live in. And so from our perspective, let's assume for a moment that nothing's going to change, although things always do. We remain in a time where macroeconomic forces, whether they be trade wars or other things, are the things that dominate the short-term decisions of investors. Will they stay in this kind of world where, you know, a lot of things that we would argue are odd at best are, we'll just say, inflexible? So how do we react to that is a big question. So the one thing we don't do is start trying to figure out how to become good macro investors, because we actually think that's impossible. The second thing we don't do is give up our advantages, and I mentioned those earlier. Patience, long time horizon for success to be earned, and diversification based on the asset pool. So we're not going to give up our advantages. How do we deal with it? And the answer is we basically just wait. I know that's not very compelling, but we basically try to draw as much optimism as we can from the fact that if people want to hand us companies for free because they're afraid of interest rates not going up ever, we'll just do that all day. And so this climate is really hostile to the way we like to think, and it really doesn't make sense. But at the same time, at least there's an incredible optimism about the future of this portfolio. It's outperformed by a lot over time, and frankly, we think, even though the last year's been a little bit of a disappointment, we think that the pent-up return in this portfolio is quite extraordinary, and I rarely say things like that. That's how bad it's gotten in the world when it comes to short-term thinking, momentum, and I don't know what else to describe it as. And this Fama-French table is a good description. Let me just clear about one more thing, if I might. the criticism, which is fair, of a French value factor, is that's all backward-looking stuff. And so you would never invest in Amazon, for example, because Amazon, on a backward-looking basis, always looks expensive, will always go in the high-priced stock category. And the reality is that if you owned Amazon the last 15 years, you never once suffered from the fact that it was a high-priced stock. You've done quite well for yourself. So Colonial and the Foundation, by extension, are not value investors per se. We call ourselves price-sensitive investors. And the reason we use that term, we draw that distinction, is that we are very happy to own very quickly growing companies that are great businesses run by great teams that are doing great things. How much about Amazon specifically? We don't know anything like that. But happy to own great businesses that look expensive on a current basis, but are actually very cheap on a long-term basis. And we pay our managers to go out and figure out what those are. And if you flip this all the way back to where we started the presentation, that's why the diversification by location, age, gender, race, and strategy all matters so much, because we are committed to this. But I do want to be clear, a lot of times people who own fast-growing companies don't really have any discipline around price. They're just momentum players. They don't admit that, but they are. We don't touch that with a 10-foot pole. So that's why we're not living on the brink of disaster, which is what all momentum players are at the end of the day. We're constantly living with one discipline in our portfolio. And for the last slide, I'll be happy to take any other questions you have, is slide 12, which I just sort of discussed a little bit. Let me make it clear. Three things that we always do here. One is we're consistent. So we will maintain our portfolio. So if people hate equities, we will own more equities. That's what consistency means. If people love equities too much, we will own less of those. And if you look at our portfolio from earlier, you'll see we own less in the U.S. and outside the United States right now. That's a perfect reflection of that. People love U.S. markets, and they're paying too much for that love. People hate everything else, and that's where our opportunity lies. Second point, which is related, volatility and emotion. No volatility, there's no emotion out there. Well, in the markets, last few years enter these eerie periods of calm, which nobody can understand. And we really don't like those periods, mainly because there's just not as much fear to, frankly, take the other side of short-term thinking. And our whole strategy is built on contrarian thinking and being on the other side of emotion. And last but not least, as I mentioned many times, this great table, I just want to emphasize again, the size of the foundation pool, the idea of combining charitable capital to a well-managed, we hope, and significantly sized pool has immense advantages. There's just no way to replicate this with smaller pool capital. So let me, again, thank you for your attention, and if you have questions, I would be delighted to answer them.
So just a reminder to unmute, press your star 6, and Mike will take your questions. Okay, no questions at this time. Oh, jump
right
in. Go ahead.
Debbie, this is Charlie Kirker, and I, as ever, appreciated Mike's eloquent explanation of the strategy and the underlying thinking. And I know, Mike, and you and I have talked another time about generation investments and their amazing outperformance over a long period of time. Do you have any comments about, whether you have taken any steps to, reduce the amount of capital allocated to them, or whether there's any change in how they're doing things that makes you worried, or are you comfortable with, steady as she goes?
Yeah, that's a great question, Charlie. Good to hear your voice, too. So we have really actually done very little to size them differently or taken money from them. And there are two things that work here. The one, even though I did make the first comment for that they're not new, they can't possibly be as good as their record research would suggest, and I stand by that comment. The fact is that Generation's done something really important in their business, which is, even though they're quite large, they don't just allow people to add money anytime they want. They're basically closed a lot of the time. So if we take money away from them, we can't necessarily put it back. And so that definitely slows down any desire we have to rebalance too much from them. And so that's why the sizing has been fairly consistent, and we're very comfortable with it, the way it stands right now, because of the quality of the fund. And we also, the related point, I think that the foundation, by the way, being here at Generation a long time, have a valuable option, which is the ability to invest in Generation. Now, to your other point, which is there anything worrying us about them? We frankly are, actually, I got to say just the opposite. They get better and better in our eyes. And actually, we're watching them start to allocate more capital up in the United States right now because the opportunity set is that much different, that much better. They've got a wonderful strategy about focusing on sustainability, and at the same time combining that with just great investing, which is they love to go to places where others aren't to some degree, where others don't understand businesses. And so I'm not sure this will violate anybody's rules of what is sustainable, but for example, now they're the kind of manager out there taking big positions in Microsoft, and everyone hates Microsoft as a company. Right now they've had fairly large positions in semiconductor companies around the world because people hate semiconductors, they hate anything that's capital intensive. So this is what great investing looks like. And so the answer to your question is no, there's nothing deteriorating a generation. From the moment they founded the firm, and for those who don't know them, they were founded by Al Gore and David Blunt, but with that said, Al and David don't manage the money. They hired an absolutely sharp, brilliant team, and we were fortunate to be introduced to them early on, and fortunate enough to be at least good enough to recognize their talent, because it was enormous and it was hard to miss, frankly. So no, there's no deterioration generation, which is the other reason that we're not too anxious to take money away from them. But let me get to your last part. I might have this a long answer. There is a point, though, where the position grows to the extent that we will take money away from them. We just can't. We'll not let it grow to the sky. There is a cyclicality to all of this, but we're very comfortable right now.
Thank you. Well said, and reassuring for all concerned.
Thanks, Charlie.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you so much again for joining the call. This will be onto our website, so if there's people you want to share this with, feel free to share the slide deck and the link to our website. And we will be looking forward to talking to you at our next call. I think it's sometime in September. Yeah, so it's time for September. So enjoy the summer. Hopefully we'll get it soon here. Get spring first. And we'll talk to you in September. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.